This is Daniel Lindley, February 10th, 2000, Psyche as Poet.
Presentation for the Young Society. This evening we're going to hear Daniel Lindley. Dan began college as a zoology major, but he took a required English course in his freshman year and was so inspired by the instructor that his whole orientation changed and he went on to be an English literature major. He started out teaching English for 9 years in junior and senior high school before he went back for his doctorate and becoming professor of English and finally head of the English education at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He's lectured, he did one series of lectures at the Wordsworth Summer School in Grasmere, England, Wordsworth's own hometown, an experience he values highly. He's currently on the faculty of the C.G. Jung Institute in Chicago, and is the author of This Rough Magic, The Life of Teaching, as well as articles on rhetoric, pedagogy, photography, and Jungian approaches to fairy tales. So will you join me in welcoming Dan Lindley?
Thank you, and thank you all very much for being here. I will be assisted tonight by my wife, Lucia Woods, whom I've asked to read the poems, most of the poems that I'm going to use as examples. I begin with an image from a poem, but which could just as well be an image from a dream. It is a famous image, but I would like you to imagine it as a dream you have had. And in the dream, a man you have never seen before makes an invitation to you, an invitation that will take you away from the ordinary life that you lead and into a world that is his and which is unfamiliar to you. And he begins this by saying, "Let us go then, you and I." And you see, when he says, "Let us go then, you and I," you can feel from that that you have already worked out something, you see, as if you've sort of been stuck. And then he says, "Well, let's go." So you seem to have agreed to accompany him, as dreams are, and you can hear that there. And then immediately he asks you this, the whole narration turns very strange. He describes the evening as ill, ailing, injured, and above all, helpless. "Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient, etherized upon a table." And now, as your dream continues, you will accompany this man, unknown as yet to you, to a slightly menacing, shadowy part of town. "Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels." As in a dream, you are caught up and going along, and you have no choice. The world of the poem and the world of the dream compel us to enter, to go along. Our cherished ability to make what we call rational choices is suspended, and there is nothing we can do about it. We are caught in the poem as we are caught in our own dreams. Poetry and dream. These two domains of human experience provoke the same questions. Where does a poem come from? Where do dreams come from? Why are dreams so often apparently incomprehensible or chaotic? Why does poetry so often seem oblique or overly intricate or obscure? This last question turned up over and over again in the 9 years during which I taught junior and senior high school English. The class and I would work through a poem, often, I'm afraid, more carefully and more boringly than adolescents would have on their own. Then, when we'd squeezed out all the meaning of the poem and neatly summarized it on the blackboard, someone would almost always cry out, "Well, if that's what it means, why didn't he just say it?" Well, it's a good question. And I'm sure you have asked the same question of many of your dreams, particularly if you have worked on them in journal work or in analysis or just in meditative reflection. So what is going on here? What is the purpose of this obfuscation, this indirection, this continual barrage of absolutely novel experience? So we are in the presence, in poetry and dream, of experience that is new to us. We aren't usually very welcoming of this. We'd prefer our life to be lived mostly within predictable patterns rather than to have it disturbed by the outlandish or the weird. I say mostly. Obviously, we seek out some new experiences, but even when we do that, we still want control. Travel, for example, is such a searching for new, but we would rather not have the cruise ship sink. Swimming is fine, but not among sharks. Some years ago, I was the co-leader of a dream discussion group in an inpatient psychiatric ward. Patients were encouraged to share dreams with the assurance that anything they said would remain confidential, would not be written into their charts or discussed outside the group. Patients came and went, insurance being what it is these days. But every few weeks, someone would dream of swimming in the ocean and being attacked by a shark. Sometimes the shark would just menace the swimmer, and sometimes the shark would take the swimmer underwater. No one was ever dismembered or killed, though. I still think about how this dream kept turning up in successive groups of patients who were unknown to one another. Most of the people who dreamed this dream were hospitalized for major depression. Many had attempted suicide. Common sense, whatever that may be, would say that such a dream isn't exactly encouraging for a person who is depressed and suicidal, but dream it they did. I will say more about this later. But now, I just want you to notice how unexpected, how just plain wrong, this dream seems to our rational minds. In the hospital, the things to do were watching Oprah in the day room, or lining up for meds, or talking with nursing staff or residents. Dreaming about sharks was not part of the program. Why then did it happen? Thus we find ourselves in the presence of the unexpected. So too in poetry. I put before you now two poems about death, a subject about which there is an enormous body of acceptable, predictable response. Neither of these poems has anything to do with those responses, though. Here's the first. Little Willie from the mirror sucked the mercury all off, thinking in his childish error it would cure the whooping cough. At his funeral, his weeping mother smartly said to Mrs. Brown, 'Twas a chilly day for Willie when the mercury went down. Forgive me. But you see, this is hardly conventional. We do not expect such wit from this grieving mother. But there is something courageous about it, too. With her awful joke, this mother has honored the irreverent life of Willie, a life we know about from the many, many other little Willie poems. Don't get me off on that subject. The unexpected element here is that the mother is in better psychological shape than we might have expected. Now consider this poem by E. Housman.
The night is freezing fast. Tomorrow comes December. And winter falls of old are with me from the past. And chiefly I remember how Dick would hate the cold. Fall, winter, fall. For he, prompt hand and headpiece clever, has woven a winter robe and made of earth and sea his overcoat forever, and wears the turning globe.
Here you see is the same unexpected idea. Dick, who has died, was not adapted, it seems, to the ordinary cycling of the seasons. He would hate the cold. In a larger sense, he was not comfortable in the world as it was when he lived in it. But now, after death, he wears the turning globe. He now turns with the seasons. He is at peace in a way he had not been in life. Furthermore, he has done this for himself in a creative way. He has woven a winter robe, which is a poetical notion, but this is then immediately restated more prosaically. He took the earth and sea and made an overcoat of it. An overcoat. Think of it. a humble garment adapted to its purpose. Dick, like Little Willie's mother, has somehow prevailed in the face of death. We are not well prepared for this quirky switch. So death in the first poem is funny, and in the second, comfortable. Depressed people dream of being attacked by sharks. Last night, you dreamed of a person you haven't even thought about for 10 years. Why? Or you dreamed that you were flying around in your living room just off the floor and somehow not hitting the lamps or the furniture. Why? Dream and poem thus pose the same question by mounting their constant attacks on the ordinary. It is this attack on the ordinary that links poem and dream. Plato in the Phaedo tells us that Socrates dreamed often that he heard a voice telling him to practice and cultivate the arts, unquote. He thought that he was already doing that, philosophy being the highest of the arts, but imprisoned and waiting his execution, he reflected once again on his dream, and it occurred to him that perhaps the dream meant exactly what it said, practice the arts. Quote, perhaps it was the popular form of art that my dream intended me to practice, in which case I ought to practice and not disobey. I thought it would be safer not to take my departure before I had cleared my conscience by writing poetry, and so obeying the dream, unquote. For the rest of this talk, I want to expand on this idea that writing poetry is obeying the dream. By this I mean that we are open to the dream while we are in it, just as the poet is open to experience that most of the time we pass over or are distracted from by the press of our daily doings. So we need to understand something about what a dream is and what a poem is. I'm going to be very particular about this. For my previous life as a teacher of English, I am still carrying around ideas from the field of rhetoric. I propose to apply some of them to dream and poem now. Bear with me. This is the thinking function section of this talk. Feelers, sensation types, and intuitives, your time is coming. Rhetoric is the study of what happens between people when one person is trying to communicate with another person or with a group. It is a field of study which begins with Plato and Aristotle, and it has a long and distinguished history. I mention this because the word has had its true meaning blurred by such phrases as empty rhetoric, or by people who describe what a politician says as just rhetoric, meaning words full of sound and fury, but signifying nothing. Aristotle helps us understand rhetoric's real meaning. He gives us this succinct and subtle definition, quote, rhetoric is the faculty of observing in any given case the available means of persuasion, unquote. So rhetoric is a faculty, that is, a skill, an ability. The Greek word in the Aristotle is techne, which is, of course, the root of our word technique. Specifically, then, rhetoric is a technique for observing persuasion. But what does observe mean? Observe is a delightfully ambiguous term, both in English and in Aristotle's Greek. It can mean either to see, as in, I observed the traffic light turn red, or it can mean to do, as in, I stopped my car for the red light because I was observing the law. Thus, rhetoric applies both to what a speaker does and to what an audience does. Assuming that there are ways of persuading, the speaker observes some of those ways by carrying them out, and the audience observes the speaker doing the carrying out, as, for example, right now. In either case, what is being observed are the available means of persuasion. Aristotle, true to form, gives us a wonderful long catalog of all those means of persuasion, which, thankfully, we can skip. But we need to pay close attention to the idea of persuasion. Persuasion isn't possible unless there is some difference between the speaker and the listener, or communicator and respondent, in rhetoric ease. Here is this idea for an article by Richard Young and Alton Becker. Quote, if a writer has anything new to say, his image of the world must be in some way different from that of his reader. It is at this point of difference that his message lies. He may seek to expand or clarify some feature of the reader's image, thus making it more nearly like his own, or he may seek to replace some feature of the reader's image. In the first instance, he would be informing, in the second, persuading. In other words, if I add something to what you know tonight, I've informed you of something. If you came in here with an idea and that gets undone, do you see what I mean? And something new takes its place, then I've persuaded you of something. Now, this is important. If there is no difference in the worldview of writer and reader or speaker and audience, then rhetoric isn't involved because no persuasion is involved. If I, as a Jungian analyst, assert to you, a Jungian group, that dreams are important, nothing has happened that brings rhetoric into play. A lot of political oratory is like that, preaching to the choir. Persuasion is what we're talking about here, and persuasion is subtle, difficult, and worth studying. If we are moved a bit by Little Willie's mother's courage, we are persuaded, slightly and momentarily to be sure, of the resiliency of the human spirit. And any successful poem will persuade us in part because of its unexpectedness. Our worldview is slightly thrown asunder when we think of Dick happily wearing his overcoat forever. I'll return to this point about poetry, but now I want to take up the rhetorical dimension of dreaming. If we say, and we do, that the source of the dream is our unconscious, meaning our own personal unconscious, or the collective unconscious, or the objective psyche, as Jungians designate the source of archetypal dreams, then, by definition, it seems there's a fundamental point of difference between the communicator and respondent, because the communicator is the unconscious and the respondent is the conscious mind of the dreamer. We don't usually respond to the dream in the dream. Rather, we respond later when we're writing the dream down or reflecting on it. Those things we do consciously. Thus, rhetorical theory is apparently appropriate as a way to think about dreaming. When we dream, that is, we observe, experience, the means of persuasion that are available, quote-unquote, to the unconscious. Then when we look at the dream after the fact, as, for example, in an analytic session, we observe the ways the dream persuaded us. By doing this, we make it possible for the dream to persuade us of something. But there's a big problem if we seek a rhetorical relationship between the unconscious and consciousness. From the unconscious come images, symptoms, feelings, emotions, projections. These are available to us as perceived, experienced elements in the dream. But we cannot speak of rhetoric here because the communicator, the unconscious itself, is unavailable to us in any way. Of course, it has, in Jung and Becker's sense, something new to say to us every night. But we have no access to the source of those communications. So we can't apply rhetoric to the relationship between our unconscious and our consciousness. The unconscious is both too hidden and too vast. We cannot address questions to it directly. I am also not persuaded that recent studies of brain function will help us here. MRI images don't look like dream images to me. My mind would be changed about this, though, if a radiologist watching a screen were to report seeing Lita attacked by a swan. Meanwhile, though, please bear in mind that the unconscious is unconscious. By definition, we cannot know it in its essence. The maps that we Jungians draw with places labeled persona, ego, shadow, I do this all the time when I'm teaching in the Institute, you know, complex archetype lines. These maps create an illusion of knowledge. But they have no more basis in fact than did those maps that showed the lost continent of Atlantis. We know that there is an unconscious because it manifests itself in three ways: projections, physical symptoms, and dreams. But knowing manifestations doesn't mean we know anything about the unconscious itself. This is a constant problem for candidates in training to be analysts. They talk about the unconscious as if they knew these things as external facts. Therefore, we cannot imagine, because we cannot know the unconscious, we cannot imagine how it goes about trying to persuade us of anything. End of discussion about what seems to be the big difference. But there is still rhetorical work to do. The dream, as of course you know, is experienced by the dream ego. At first, this looks like a rhetorical relationship, because the dream ego is usually pretty much like our conscious self, and yet it's experiencing the strange new stuff of the dream. But remember that there has to be a point of difference if rhetoric is to be brought to bear. The fact is, though, that no matter how bizarre your dream content may be, the dream ego is almost never taken by surprise by it. For example, if you had a dream similar to the one I mentioned of flying through your living room 3 inches off the ground and not hitting anything, while you are in the dream, that's just happening. The dream ego does it. It's just what it is. It's not until you wake up and think about it that it seems odd. Do you,
Do you see the thing? Because the dream ego is in the dream. And so it is not astonished by it. Usually. Unless, of course, there's something in the dream that would astonish the dream ego. I mean, a monster and so forth. But then that's a different... Do you see what I mean? You would be astonished. That's still true to the way the dream ego, and you would be. So there's no point of difference between the dream ego and the dream because the dream ego is already in it. Now I want to give you an example of this for my practice. I should mention that these examples for my practice are given by permission of the patients, and I'm very grateful to them for that. This dreamer retired from his life's work a year before he had this dream, and in general it would be fair to say that his analysis had as one of its themes the fact of his retirement, his beginning a new way of life. An element of my countertransference to him was that he was the only person in my practice who was older than me. I came to this late in life, you understand. And that was a pleasing thing because we had an equality. We looked for guidance from each other. It was an interesting relationship. And the other thing you need to know about this man is that except for his very early childhood, he grew up entirely in the city of New Orleans. And that is important for this dream. So here's his dream. I am doing something with some guys. One of the older guys seems quite directive in giving advice for something I am to do. Then I and one of the other guys are to go catch a streetcar. But the streetcar is more like a boat, and it runs alongside a stream or canal with vegetation along it. We go to the end of the line to get it. There I see what is a cross between a barge, a skiff, and a streetcar. See, note that. Dream ego isn't surprised by that. The sides are just a foot or so above the water. As we move along for quite a distance, the other youngish guy I am with says we'll have to get off soon. I realize we'll have to walk quite a distance the rest of the way to our destination. That's the end of the dream. Now, how many of you have ever seen a streetcar that's more like a boat? Or a cross between a barge, a skiff, and a streetcar? Whatever these things are, they seem to me as rare as a purple cow. But you see, the dream ego just takes it all in. The dream ego isn't puzzled or surprised at all. Once again, then, we can speak of a rhetorical relationship between the dream ego and the waking ego. The dream ego says, in effect, there's something perfectly ordinary about this. The waking ego does not say that, so they differ. They have something to say to each other. Consider the situation of the dreamer. Retirement has happened. He feels the paradoxical mix of new opportunity together with the loss of his earlier way of life, a way more active in a youthful sense. The dream ego encounters this strange conveyance, streetcar, an obvious reference to New Orleans in his past, and barge boat skiff, closer to the river, another New Orleans echo, perhaps. More important, though, is the feeling that the dream ego is not free to choose anything here. An older guy is directive in giving advice. A youngish guy says, we'll have to get off soon, and so on and so on. He's just been moving along like that. Dream ego just goes along. Under this dream, then, and this emerged slowly as we talked it over, there is, and by the way, I always think when Jungians talk about working on a dream, it always makes it seem as if the meaning of the dream was just sort of right there and any fool could see it. And of course, that isn't really true at all. What we're talking about here is long talk. Do you see what I mean? As things slowly surface. So, and this did surface slowly. There is a theme of traveling somewhere and not having any choice about it, but with other people who know more about it. And the streetcar boat is ambiguous. Are we going to go on land or are we going to go on water? And if we're to go on water, the water will evidently be a stream or a canal. In other words, not a lake or the ocean. Indeed, the streetcar boat image suggests moving from land to water in some ambiguous way. We are now in the presence of a very old image, the boat that ferries souls across the river. From the land where life is lived to the far shore, the western shore, the land of eternity. With this in mind, we can better understand why the dream ego goes along so readily. After all, what choice does it have? And when the time comes, is it not reasonable to suppose that we will make this journey in the presence of others who know more than we and who will act as guides? Such figures appear in this dream, to be sure, just as they are represented by Chiron, the boatman, or the Egyptian jackal god Anubis. This dream, you see, is like the Little Willie poem or the A.E. Houseman poem. It says to the dreamer that he is to go and catch a streetcar and that he has no choice about it. And then we get the boat, the stream, and the guides. Not things that would be comfortable to the conscious ego of the dreamer, but necessary for a picture of the entirety of his life's path. Indeed, as the dream says, he is, quote, going to the end of the line. As are we all. We are all sliding down the razor blade of life. It is not easy to be really open to this idea. But the dream ego is open here. Remember how the dream ends. I realize we'll have to walk quite a distance the rest of the way to our destination. Indeed, that distance is the distance to the afterlife. We are in the presence of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, where this is called the soul's coming forth by day, or we are in the presence of the beginning of Dante's journey, midway in the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wood. All this is dream ego is open to, as ours would be, were the dream ours. This means that we can and do have a rhetorical relationship between our waking ego and the dream ego in our dreams. This relationship begins the second we wake up and record the dream or think about it. This moment and what we do in it is crucial. The natural tendency is to try as quickly as possible to wake up and then stay in the daylit rational world of the waking ego. Why? Because the dream has been about something that the waking ego has been avoiding. That is the whole meaning of Jung's doctrine that dreams compensate the conscious attitude. But note, please note, the dream ego has no such feeling. Over and over again, we see that the dream ego is perfectly comfortable within the dream. From this, we know that it is open to what we would rather deny and avoid. Its openness makes for a fundamental point of difference, the very point of difference required by rhetorical theory between the dream ego and the waking ego. The dream ego is always in a position to either inform us of something by expanding or clarifying something we already knew, or to persuade us by seeking to change some feature of our habitual, usually unexamined image of the world. In fact, you can't clarify or change one without clarifying or changing the other. The openness of the dream ego is our bridge to what we have not yet known, considered, or experienced. And here's my fundamental point. The dream ego lives in the world of the dream the way the poet lives in the daylit world. The poet is open. The process of creating a poem is a process of discovery, and precisely of discovering what had been previously unknown. Robert Frost, in his preface to his 1939 collected poems, wrote that for him, a poem succeeded when, quote, I find out something I didn't know I knew. Thus, the poet wanders around in her psyche, exploring and then reporting on what she has found out. We all do this some, but poets must do it, or the poem has nothing new to say. That is, it has no rhetorical force. It is discovery that makes poetry work on us. As Ezra Pound said, literature is news that stays news. He also said, with what I think is forgivable if characteristic inflation, that poets are the antennae of the race. Well, that's Pound. You see how he is saying what Frost said. Poetry reports discoveries in the psyche. So does the dream ego. Which brings me to my central point. The dream ego and the poet are open to their experience in a way that most of us have pretty much lost. This openness, I suggest, is caused by their proximity to the unconscious. And out of this closeness, there develops an ease, a comfort, if you will, in the presence of symbolic as opposed to literal experience. My patient's stream canal dream suggests, delicately, the journey to the underworld. Most of us are not so comfortable with this as the dream ego is. Think of your feelings as you see a hearse drive by, or what your feelings would be if you were to accompany a first-year medical student into the gross anatomy dissecting room. My office, as it happens, is in a building that was once, a long time ago, a funeral home. There isn't much evidence of that left, although there are still bays in the classrooms downstairs where people were once laid out. But the building's elevator does give pause for thought. It is long but narrow. In other words, you could lie down in it. You get the idea. We aren't completely comfortable around death in our consciousness, but the unconscious is much more attuned to it because the unconscious is already timeless. One of the great poets of openness to death, if I may put it that way, was Emily Dickinson, and here is an example.
I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service, like a drum, kept beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll. As all the heavens were a bell and being but an ear, and I and silence, some strange race wrecked solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then.
She begins by observing a funeral, but the last stanza tells us whose funeral it is. And I dropped down and down and hit a world at every plunge and finished knowing then. Imagine imagining that. And not just imagining it, imaging it, putting it out into language where it has to be faced. Words on a paper. Now, is it your custom to take a break? And then a lot of the chocolate ones are still there. Should we have a workshop on exploring the shadow? Or yeah. Oh, there were more vanilla to see. I tell you, there's always more work to be done. No. Dear me. So, the parallel I've insisted upon so far is the parallel between the dream ego on the one hand and the poet on the other, in that both the dream ego and the poet are open to their experience in a way that we ordinarily are not. And now I want to go to another equally powerful example of that kind of openness. And the example I want to use now is the example of the openness of children. We know that children dream archetypal dreams much more frequently than adults do. And we know that children live much more easily among archetypes. Theirs is a more magical world than is ours. The child is like the dream ego in this. The child, too, usually just goes along, exploring, experiencing, trying, yes, to make sense of things, but primarily just experiencing for its own sake. We have talked about openness to death. The child encourages us to talk about openness to life, to any experience. Here is a poem by E.E. Cummings about that.
Maggie and Millie and Molly and May went down to the beach to play one day. And Maggie discovered a shell that sang so sweetly she couldn't remember her troubles. And Millie befriended a stranded star whose rays five languid fingers were. And Molly was chased by a horrible thing which raced sideways while blowing bubbles. And May came home with a smooth round stone as small as a world and as large as a loan. For whatever we lose, like a you or a me, it's always ourselves we find in the sea.
And here now is another dream from my practice. The dreamer is a middle-aged woman whose history includes 2 suicide attempts followed by 2 hospitalizations for major depression. In this dream, she is about 11 years old. She and some friends are in an amusement park. Think of that, a depressed person in an amusement park. They go over to a huge Ferris wheel and buy tickets and get on. As it starts up, she is apprehensive, and the higher she goes, the more scared she becomes. Then, as luck would have it, the wheel stops just when she and her friends are at the very top. They are so high up that the rest of the amusement park is almost invisible. She is petrified. Then the wheel begins to descend, at first slowly, and then more and more quickly. She is surprised to find that the faster she moves down, the better she feels. Her anxiety is disappearing. They sweep toward the ground at great speed, but the wheel stops again just as their seat arrives at ground level, and she hops off, full of enthusiasm. She wants to do the whole thing over again. And she awoke from the dream, feeling more cheerful than she had in months. Let's begin with her being 11 years old in the dream. Her history shows us that by the time she was, in fact, 11, her older brothers had begun to break away from the idea that they would become priests, an idea very much supported by the dysfunctional parents. Another sister had developed a serious eating disorder. All this left my patient as the only responsible person in the family, a role she carried for years until she fled it by going into the convent. In a sense, we could say that the dream takes us back to the point in her history where she had to give up being a child. But the dream also shows us that she is fearful about going up, but not about coming down. In other words, she fears being high, not in a pharmacological sense, but in the sense of being inflated, superior, detached from the ground. This turns out to be very true for her. Being the de facto responsible person, oh, I have to say again there. Now, see, that sounds like a reading of the dream, and it is, but it isn't a reading of the dream that you would see just by reading the dream. Do you understand? That develops out of the conversation in the sessions. I have to continually emphasize that, I think. I'm trying to be very careful not to imply that an analyst somehow has some kind of a magic lens that enables the analyst to see into the meaning of the dream. That's not what it is. It's a question of the give and take. That's how you know what eventually what's going on. So it is true, as I say, that she was fearful about feeling superior because being the de facto responsible person in her family carried with it the idea that she had to become an adult while she was still really a child. In other words, at an age when she should have been experiencing the imaginative flights and fun of childhood, she was grounded by having to take out the trash, wait up for the intoxicated father, hide the grocery money, and all those things. This was simply too much for her. But in the dream, she feels better as she gets back to the ground, as she gets back to being just with her friends at the amusement park, to being really 11 years old, in other words. That happy moment, when they all return to the ground, still as children, was unavailable to her in real life, but it is wonderfully present in the dream. So, while her life in the outside world remained painful and constrained, there is an inner figure, this 11-year-old, who correctly fears being taken to an inappropriate height, that is, growing up, but who was happy to be where she is, on the ground. The image of the happy 11-year-old stayed with her and was a constant source of renewal. Parenthetically, the dream also suggested the possibility that the depression we were seeing was not really a major depression in the DSM-4 sense. Instead, the wheel suggested that we might be looking at unipolar depression, that is to say, the depressive phase of bipolar disorder. Her psychiatrist agreed to a trial of treatment with lithium, And there was real improvement over time. It's an illuminating example of how the image and the body combine to make meaning. In the dream, her fear and her exaltation are both very physical. The turning Ferris wheel is an emblem for a cycling of mania and depression. A symbol needn't be exclusively an image. It can also represent or be represented by a physical bodily experience. In this case, the child, crushed by the weight of tasks placed on this person by irresponsible parents, and later by tasks imposed by the convent, had disappeared from the consciousness of this woman, with the result that her life had become profoundly joyless. But within her psyche, the child was alive and well, as we could see from the dream. The child is open. It can experience both fear and delight without having to choose between them. Above all, it wants to do the whole thing over and over. An amusement park, after all, is the place for that. Now we have three figures to consider with our rational out-in-the-world conscious ego: the poet, the dream ego, and the child. They share the characteristic of uncritical, eager openness. Another way to say this is to say that they are not inhibited or blocked by disruptive complexes. For example, most of us have had at one time or another been preoccupied by the task of achievement, caught up to some degree in the myth of the hero or the myth of the virtuous parent or the image of the community leader or some such other ambitious notion of what we should be doing with our lives. Compare this with Emily Dickinson.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog. To tell your name the livelong June to an admiring bog.
It's hard, for me at least, to imagine Al Gore, or Bill Bradley, or George W., or for that matter, Bill Gates, or Puff Daddy, taking such a stance. I don't mean that being driven toward achievement is necessarily a bad thing. What I do mean, though, is that to be driven toward anything by a complex rather than by a freely operating psyche is a bad thing. In poetry and dream, we see more closely than anywhere else the free operation of psyche, and it is to that idea that I now turn. The free operation of psyche sounds exhilarating, but what does that mean? In its highest expression, it means the work of the great ones in any field. Harold Bloom, in his new book about Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, gives us an account of how the body of Shakespeare's work reflects the entire range of human character and experience. Everything is there because nothing is blocked. Perhaps we could say the same thing about Beethoven, or Dante, or Milton, or Homer. But notice that these examples come from the past, the distant past. Our world is different. How different? 40 years ago, W.H. Auden wrote of four aspects of our present Weltanschauung which have made the artistic vocation more difficult than it used to be. His points have even more force now. Four aspects of the present, the way the world is now, the present Weltanschauung. Four aspects of, thank you for asking, please ask questions. That's nice, thank you. Four aspects of the way the world is that make it harder to have an artistic vocation than it was previously. And these are the four aspects. One, the loss of belief in the eternity of the physical universe. I'm quoting Auden now. The possibility of becoming an artist, a maker of things which shall outlast the maker's life, might never have occurred to man had he not had before his eyes, in contrast to the transitoriness of human life, a universe of things, earth, ocean, sky, sun, moon, stars, etc., which appeared to be everlasting and unchanging.
physics, geology, and biology have now replaced this everlasting universe with a picture of nature as a process in which nothing is now what it was or will be. It is difficult for a modern artist to believe he can make an enduring object when he has no model of endurance to go by. He is more tempted than his predecessors to abandon the search for perfection as a waste of time and be content with sketches and improvisations. Two, the loss of belief in the significance and reality of sensory phenomena. Hitherto, the traditional conception of the phenomenal world had been one of sacramental analogies. What the senses perceived was an outward and visible sign of the inward and invisible, but both were believed to be real and valuable. Modern science has destroyed our faith in the naive observation of our senses. We cannot, it tells us, ever know what the physical universe is really like. We can only hold whatever subjective notion is appropriate to the particular human purpose we may have in view. This destroys the traditional concept of art as mimesis, that is to say, art as imitation of nature. For there is no longer any nature out there to be truly or falsely imitated. All an artist can be true to are his subjective sensations and feelings. The way in which men lived changed so slowly that any man, thinking of his great-grandchildren, could imagine them living the same kind of life with the same kind of needs and satisfactions as himself. Technology, with its ever-accelerating transformation of man's way of living, has made it impossible for us to imagine what life will be like even 20 years from now. And that was written 40 years ago, before email. The artist, therefore, no longer has any assurance when he makes something, then even the next generation will find it enjoyable or comprehensible. He cannot help desiring an immediate success with all the danger to his integrity that that implies. Four, the disappearance of the public realm as the sphere of revelatory personal deeds. To the Greeks, the private realm was the sphere of life ruled by the necessity of sustaining life, and the public realm, the sphere of freedom, where a man could disclose himself to others. Today, the significance of the terms private and public has been reversed. Public life is the necessary impersonal life, the place where a man fulfills his social function. You have to forgive him, man. You do understand this was written a long time ago. The place where a man fulfills his social function, and it is in his private life that he is free to be his personal self. In consequence, the arts, literature in particular, have lost their traditional principal human subject, the man of action, the doer of public deeds. One way to experience that readily is to go through a major art museum chronologically and look and watch the disappearance of people in the public realm from painting. You will just see that occur. You go from the religious painting, the 16th and 17th century, the 18th century public paintings of people on, elegant people on horseback, and then in the 19th century you begin to see the public realm dissolving into something else. In consequence, the arts, literature in particular, have lost their traditional principal human subject, the man of action, the doer of public deeds. This last point, that's the end of the quote, the last point may be amplified in a Jungian way. If public life is the necessary impersonal life, then it has been stripped of its symbolic value. It is merely a persona-driven public performance. But we know from analytic work that the symbolic cannot be just buried and ignored. It asserts itself against all odds, in dreams and art anyway. In my practice, I saw a number of people whose work life uncannily mirrored the architecture of the complexes with which they had grown up. A woman whose family only rewarded her when she did exactly what they demanded, different from the dreamer, but the same general climate, ends up working in a law firm where the only thing that mattered was billable time. Anything else, including just trying to work harmoniously with colleagues, was literally ignored.
This is more than the repetition compulsion, which has to do with the reassurance that comes from the familiar. This has to do with a reluctance to create, to make something new psychically. The escape from this psychological dead end in the work is provided by the symbolic attitude, what Jung called the transcendent function. To see the law office not as a literal law office, but as a psychological structure, a family, is the beginning of the way out. The waking ego lives the literal life, or tries to. The dream ego, the child, and the poet, they lead the life informed by the symbolic dimension. The difficulties that Auden listed are real, but they are not fatal. In spite of each and all of them, the symbol is recreated dream by dream and poem by poem still. And the source never dries up. I'll end, therefore, with a description of the symbolic attitude. In the first place, bear in mind that the symbolic attitude is out of phase with ordinary experience, ordinary living. D.W. Winnicott's wonderful elaboration of the transitional object indicates this. That famous teddy bear is neither teddy bear nor mother, but somewhere in between, in liminal space, suspended between its factuality and the child's psyche. All symbols are transitional objects. Their liminality, their protean shape shifting, is what makes them anathema to people for whom imagination is threatening. The right wing's fundamentalist attachment to literal fact, whether in the world or in the Bible, provides an example of what it means to flee from the symbol. I bought a little button today that says, the Christian right is neither. Literalness literally destroys the image, and with it the whole domain of imagination. D.W. Winnicott helps us to see the bleak poverty of a life lived in literalness. He writes, "It is creative apperception more than anything else that makes the individual feel that life is worth living. Contrasted with this is a relationship to external reality, which is one of compliance, the world and its details being recognized, but only as something to be fitted in with or demanding adaptation. Compliance carries with it a sense of futility for the individual and is associated with the idea that nothing matters and that life is not worth living. In a tantalizing way, many individuals have experienced just enough of creative living to recognize that for most of the time they are living uncreatively, as if caught up in the creativity of someone else or of a machine. These two alternatives of living creatively or uncreatively can be very sharply contrasted. We have to take note that for many individuals, external reality remains to some extent a subjective phenomenon. There exist all sorts of expressions for this state. Fey, not all there, feet off the ground, unreal, and so on. And psychiatrically, we refer to such individuals as schizoid. We find clinically no sharp line between health and the schizoid state. People may be leading satisfactory lives and may do work that is even of exceptional value and yet be schizoid or schizophrenic. They may be ill in a psychiatric sense because of a weak reality sense. To balance this, one would have to state that there are others who are so firmly anchored in objectively perceived reality that they are ill in the opposite direction of being out of touch with the subjective world and with a creative approach to fact. And I would say it's that latter piece that Jungians encounter in practice a lot. Another way of thinking about these two kinds of people was put to me by a wise English teacher colleague some years ago. He said that if there were ever to be another civil war in this country, it would be between those people who see change as a necessary component of the human condition, and those people who fear change and resist it at every turn. For you cannot be open, in the child, dream ego, poet sense, and at the same time resist change. Openness requires acceptance of the new, the novel, the never before seen, or felt, or thought. So how is openness achieved? Or to ask the same question in another way, what do poets do? More to our point, what do they do that we can do too? There are many wonderful documents describing what poets do or what poetry should do. Aristotle's Poetics, Sidney's Defense of Poetry, Shelley's Defense, Wordsworth's Preface to the Lyrical Ballads, the 15th chapter of Coleridge's Biographia Literaria, Keats's Negative Capability Letter to his brother, on and on. Each is important because we have the word of a person practicing the art, but the documents I want to make use of are two essays by T.S. Eliot. Jung has said some things about poetry too, and his invention of active imagination resulted in a technique that parallels poetic creation, but I want to stay with the poet. My first instance is Eliot's essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent. As I'm sure many of you know, Eliot was criticized, or at least made fun of, over the notes he appended to The Wasteland. Erudition, a maniacal devotion to obscure quotations and just plain crazy little facts, like what an English bird sound, a particular bird sounds like in the springtime. A maniacal devotion to obscure quotations seemed too much a part of his method. Wendy Cope wrote some limericks about all this and called them wasteland limericks. Here are a few. You remember the wasteland, remember the beginning of it? April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and general. Okay. In April, one seldom feels cheerful. Dry stones, sun, and dust make me fearful. Clairvoyants distress me. Commuters depress me. Met Stetson and gave him an earful. The Thames runs, bones rattle, rats creep. Tiresias fancies a peep. A typist is laid. A record is played. Way la la, after this it gets deep. No water, dry rocks and dry throats, then thunder, a shower of quotes from the Sanskrit and Dante Dum Dum Yata Shanti. I hope you'll make sense of the notes. Actually, Eliot appended the notes to The Wasteland because otherwise there wouldn't have been enough pages to make up the little quarto pamphlet that was the first published version of the poem. So there they are. And they do pose the question dealt with in Eliot's essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent. In it, he wrote, quote, "What is to be insisted upon is that the poet must develop or procure the consciousness of the past, and that he should continue to develop this consciousness throughout his career. What happens is a continual surrender of himself as he is at the moment to something which is more valuable. The process of an artist is a continual self-sacrifice, a continual extinction of personality. There remains to define this process of depersonalization and its relation to the sense of tradition. It is in this depersonalization that art may be said to approach the condition of science. I therefore invite you to consider, as a suggestive analogy, the action which takes place when a finely filiated bit of platinum is introduced into a chamber containing oxygen and sulfur dioxide." At this point, the first half of Eliot's essay ended in the Criterion, the journal which Eliot was editing and in which the essay was originally published. So if you were reading this essay, you had to wait for the next issue to find out what on earth he was writing about here. So the next issue came out, and he continued, "I hinted by an analogy that the mind of the mature poet differs from that of the immature poet not precisely in any valuation of personality, not being necessarily more interesting or having more to say, but rather by being a more finely perfected medium in which special or very varied feelings are at liberty to enter into new combinations. The analogy was that of the catalyst. When the two gases previously mentioned are mixed in the presence of a filament of platinum, they form sulfurous acid. The combination takes place only if the platinum is present. Nevertheless, the newly formed acid contains no trace of platinum, and the platinum itself is apparently unaffected, has remained inert, neutral, and unchanged. The mind of the poet is the shred of platinum. It may partly or exclusively operate upon the experience of the man himself, but the more perfect the artist, the more completely separate in him will be the man who suffers and the mind which creates. The more perfectly will the mind digest and transmute the passions which are its material. Let me restate that in Jungian terms. The distinction here is between the person who suffers, quote unquote, and the mind which creates. For the person who suffers, read the conscious ego. For the mind which creates, read the dream ego. Thus, the person who lives in the world lives ordinarily, consciously, as do we all, as indeed we must. But the creating mind does not participate in the ordinary flow of events. Rather, it synthesizes new material out of the ordinary life situations which it experiences. A man retires, changes his life, so much is fact. But the mind which creates presents him with a streetcar that's also a boat. He has a brand new way to move along, and he invented it himself. Out of his life, the creative aspect of his psyche has crafted an image. Those patients who dreamed of sharks were dreaming, really, of an experience of transformation, to go underwater toward the unconscious, to be taken down by a huge primitive beast, to begin a transformation. It is Jonah. At a dark time, a transforming image is created. That creative aspect of the psyche is itself unchanged. It is the shred of platinum. So too, the creative mind of the poet, there is no difference. It takes experience and transforms it into symbol. In Jungian terms, we are looking at the transcendent function in action. Jung writes, quote, "There is nothing mysterious or metaphysical about the term transcendent function. It means a psychological function comparable in its way to a mathematical function of the same name, which is a function of real and imaginary numbers." I just had to interrupt myself because I realized that in my first year in college, when I was still thinking of zoology, I was thinking to take a mathematics course, and I was never good at mathematics in high school, but I had to take the course. And I sat way in the back because I was already nervous. And the professor came in, and he went up to the blackboard, and he put some figures on the blackboard, and he said, "Now," he said, "those are real numbers," which, you know, I had no quarrel with that. They looked real to me. And then he wrote some more things on the blackboard, looked just the same, and then he turned around and he said, "Now those are imaginary numbers." I was glad I was sitting in the back. I gathered up my books and just sort of crept out, and it was part of the beginning of my change. So I suddenly realized that this passage has this. The psychological transcendent function arises from a union of conscious and unconscious contents. The whole procedure of active imagination is a kind of enrichment and clarification of the affect, whereby the affect and its contents are brought nearer to consciousness, becoming at the same time more impressive and more understandable. A product is created which is influenced by both conscious and unconscious, embodying the striving of the unconscious for the light and the striving of the conscious for substance, unquote. But what opposites? For our purpose here, the opposites are represented by the conscious ego and the dream ego, or by the child and the adult. One is open, the other is not. But they can and do talk with one another. Out of this talk comes the expression of images. If there were no conscious ego, there would be no reason for poetry. If there were no dream ego, there would be no source for poetry. Let me say that again. If there were no conscious ego, there would be no reason for poetry. In other words, if there were no entity to be persuaded. If there were no dream ego, there would be no source for poetry. Each needs the other. Out of these opposites, a third thing, the poem or the dream, is produced. Once more back to T.S. Eliot, and we are done. In his essay entitled Hamlet and His Problems, Eliot makes the following dogmatic statement, quote, "The only way of expressing emotion in the form of art," I'll say that again, "the only way of expressing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative. In other words, a set of objects, a situation, a chain of events, which shall be the formula of that particular emotion, such that when the external facts, which must terminate in sensory experience, are given, the emotion is immediately evoked. In other words, if we wish to express emotion in the form of art, we must find some specific, concrete, particular object or set of events or whatever that will express that emotion exactly. I put it to you that for the conscious mind, this is an absolutely impossible task. No one of us could sit down, feel an emotion, and then consciously search about for some object or plot or story that would exactly express what we felt. No. We need the close, intricate connection to the unconscious for the source of images. But what Eliot doesn't say is that objective correlatives, stories and poems and objects and places that carry the images of our own life's story and its deep meaning are all around us all the time. The modern problem is that we are so diverted from these by numinous objects and words by the press of, and words by the press of events, the shrill presence of these obligations that crowd into our conscious everyday life and crowd out openness to images that we do not see. As T.S. Eliot wrote, we are, quote, in a place of disaffection, time before and time after in a dim light, neither daylight investing form with lucid stillness, nor darkness to purify the soul, neither plenitude nor vacancy, only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces distracted from distraction by distraction. I ask you now, therefore, to give up for a moment thinking about the whole question we have tried to address. Let be all of this about child and dream ego and consciousness. Drop away from the rational setting of a lecture and enter instead the liminal space of imagination. Imagine being open to images, to accidental vision, to an unexpected slant of light, to the laughter of children in a garden, to a perfect rose, to an autumn leaf, to the ocean, to Cassiopeia or Orion in the night sky, to a remembered room of your childhood, to a melody that stays with you, to the sound of wind in the trees. Imagine, imagine. Then take this last poetry with you.
Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
No, let me see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying that in your waking life, there is you and an observer. We already have two. All right. So then, of course, when the dream ego gets into that, there are now at least three of you. Huh? That is to say, it's two at a time. Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, I'm glad it's not a whole bus full. Streetcar named Desire. Right. That's, exactly. Right. Morning becomes Electra. We're gonna get. I think what is happening, it sounds to me a little bit what's happening, and this is very symptomatic in a way of a Jungian community. I mean, Jungians are very observing people, you know, and so there is a created observer, so to speak, in among us that we make. For, and you may be describing that. I think that's a different kind of thing. I'm not quite sure what it is exactly. It doesn't sound to me like a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing that happens when people begin to really reflect. That companion who reflects is with you all the time, and didn't used to be. Do you see what I mean? But not when you were very small or when it came at a certain point, or it might have come out of your culture. It could have been. I mean, I shouldn't really say when it came. For me, it didn't. I know exactly when it came. It came when I took that literature course in college. I know that's when it happened. But, you know, for you, it's obviously a different history. And yet, that does create that other observer. But that is not the dream ego, and it's not the waking ego either. Do you see what I mean? It's another thing. You might want to try to get an image of what that third person, that observing, you see what I mean? What's it like? And then dialogue with it. Now, that's the kind of thing, but we won't do that tomorrow per se, but that's the kind of thing that we'll at least be in the domain of for a while. I haven't really answered your question, but I don't think I really can. But, yeah. Yeah. Let me see if I can do it from my head. I can read it, sure, but basically it's the question of where one's life is led. Is that right? I should go back. I know that's what it is, but it's the question of the public realm and the private realm. In former times, the public realm was a place where the whole person of whoever was out there was expressed in public life. And Auden argues that that has ceased to be true, that now the whole person is expressed in the private realm, in the family, or maybe being alone, but not in the public realm, because the public realm now demands a necessary, demands a necessary impersonal life in which the person is not connected to psyche at all. Do you see what I mean? You can disapprove all you want about King Lear's dividing his kingdom up amongst the daughters, but it's a public deed which absolutely expresses his state of mind at the beginning of that play. You see, whereas nowadays that family thing would stay within the family. Do you see what I mean? He wouldn't do that because it wouldn't be, you know, you don't do that. Yeah, bad PR. I mean, you can't imagine Bill Gates doing that, can you? Gets up one day and says, I got my three daughters, here's this and here's that. Right? No, it's not going to work. Because also lawyers never get all involved. What's his game? Yeah, that's right. What's you know? Which again would not be a really himself. Do you see what I mean? It would still be some stunt. See, that's right. Thank you. I mean, that really illustrates Auden's point, I think. But that's the kind of issue that Auden is raising in that fourth point. Does that help? I mean, that is what the fourth point is. Yeah. The way I find most handy to think about that is to think of Shakespeare's tragedies, because Shakespeare's tragedies are all in the public realm. But you never talk about those tragedies as political, per se. Do you see? I mean, you don't talk about those plays the way you would the history plays. We talk about them in terms of the character of Macbeth or Hamlet or King Lear or Othello. And yet, everything that those people do is public. It has vast public consequences for the state. But we don't talk about that that way. That would be the example of how things were in the time that Auden is writing about. But before things have gotten the way they are now. Yeah, but don't forget Auden's agenda here is not to write about how the world was. It's what he's writing about is what's available for art. For art, yeah, that's right. For public art, yeah. It's a very interesting question because Emily Dickinson, it's true, was very private on the one hand, but on the other hand, was very desperately involved in the public realm in a way that was poignant her whole life. She's very complicated that way. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, he would. Yeah. That's right, and that's exactly the Jungian point here, really. That's the Jungian point that flows from what Auden is saying. That we've lost that domain as a place where psyche can be expressed. And that didn't, it used to be otherwise. But now it's can't do it.
So your point is that these are
Yeah, and in fact, I think are restored, but not in the public domain. I mean, they're restored by each and every one of us if we create something. That's the value of the poet and the dreamer. Yeah, that's what I think. That's what I think. But I'm a romantic in that way. Yeah.
Giving away a lot of money to philanthropic causes is just an attempt to regain the back
Yeah, you see, I obviously can't answer the question. What interests me is what he would say, and then the question is, if you could get him to try to answer the question, would he really be answering the question, or would his answer be part of his performance in the public domain? In other words, do you see what I mean? So, you know, I mean, one of the things that happens when you start in analytic work, when you start being an analyst, is that, of course, you realize that people are with you and all that public stuff is gradually sort of dissolving because they sort of gradually understand that what they say in the analyst's office, actually, two things are just absolutely amazing. One, the other person in the room is listening, which is much rarer than you would suppose, and two, that it's going to stay in there. And that's really rare. So, That's Edinger, by the way. It has that wonderful line in Ego and Archetype. It says, you know, the first thing the patient is really astonished by is that the analyst is listening. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it's got archetypes in it, too. No question about that. Somebody should do that book. Michael Jordan as, the archetype of something or other. There is a wonderful movie, by the way, called Hoop Dream. I'm not making that up. That's a marvelous film. Yeah.
Rather than thinking of that poem and referring to something of antiquity, which we can't go back to the time of history, could it also be an analogy referring to our youth when we were younger?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Or in fact it does, as Wordsworth so often does. Yeah. Oh yeah. Both things have probably happened. Yeah. Well, oh, I'm sorry, one. I'll just say one thing about it. It's really kind of another subject. But yeah, well, it probably was. And when my editor gets to it, it'll probably go into some other chapter. This is, you know, that's what happens. But Jung said that the experience of the self, meaning the experience, any experience of the self, meaning any experience of the archetype of wholeness, anything that has the numinosity of an experience of the self, is always a defeat for the ego. And that's very important to bear in mind all the time. And I think that's really what you are talking about here. It is kind of another subject, although it certainly is related. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's why you, when you wake up from a dream, you the first instinct is not to write it down and get it. The first instinct is to wake up and leave it. Because any experience of a dream is the experience of something else. And that's always a little iffy. We'll probably talk about that tomorrow too. Thank you all very much for coming. I appreciate it a lot.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.